Okay. So those are examples about hiring algorithms and some of the real problems that exist in fairness in AI. Now we're going to talk about a couple of a joined group of discussions, which are very important in the academic world and in the real world. This idea of individual versus group fairness. And we'll talk about that in terms of privileging the group and privileging the individual in the next two sections. This is an area of very heated discussion in information technology and AI ethics. Okay, so we're talking about individual versus group fairness. What is the background of this? The idea of group fairness emerges from fairness. Well, it is fairness comparisons between groups, not individuals. So typically when we sort of are growing up and we have fairness questions, it's typically individuals, right? And we say, look, it's unfair because this person got John and wrote the same essay as I did for the class, but he got an A and I got a B, and our essays are really almost the same, but we didn't copy each other, of course, right? So our initial experiences of fairness are like that, that he got a better grade than I did, and that's not fair. Or maybe even earlier, you know, one person got a better Christmas present than the other, who knows, whatever. Our initial, I think for most of us, our initial understanding of fairness circles around experiences that we have as individuals, right? But there is also the idea of fairness in terms of groups. One group is being treated differently than another group, and we've been looking at some of those examples already. We looked at that with the skin cancer. We said, look, people with lighter skin are being treated better than people with darker skin. So something like that is a question about group fairness, which emerges. Part of it is kind of a legal basis for that. So we have in the United States and in most Western countries, there are certain laws set up to protect certain groups who have suffered harmful discrimination in the past for one or another historical reason. And so those groups are given special protections by the law in specific areas, and areas having to do with housing or hiring and so on. So there's this idea of social as opposed to individual justice, which is a part of the origin of the idea of group fairness and the idea of protected groups. So when we talk about group fairness, we frequently are talking about groups as they are collected by law, right? So we tend to talk about race and gender and so on, as opposed to we rarely talk about tall people versus short people. I was talking about that for basketball, but that's not a legal group. And so we don't generally talk about that quite as much in fairness discussions. Regardless of whether it's tall people or gender or race or what have you, the conceptual essence of what we're discussing is the question, can it be that individuals are treated fairly while collectives of same individuals are treated unfairly? What we're going to be looking at now are cases where there's a kind of fairness question in which it seems like individuals are treated fairly, but groups are treated unfairly or vice versa. This is a kind of a specific area of AI ethics. And there are two cases that we will look at. As I said, one is an argument in favor of group fairness. One is an argument against that or in favor of individual fairness. I'm going to say that both these two arguments, of course, you know that I'm sort of a critical person. I will say that both these two arguments are flawed. So the argument in favor of group fairness is flawed, but then the argument in favor of individual fairness is also flawed. So we have all kinds of problems. We continue to have them. All right. So let's talk about the group fairness issue. This is a very famous case from a few years back. Let's see, 2016. So it's almost 10 years old now. This is a foundational case, might even be the foundational case for discussions about group fairness in artificial intelligence ethics. And it stems from a group called ProPublica, which is a social activist organization. And it applies to a piece of software, which is not really artificial intelligence software. It's more information technology software. It's almost kind of a tree diagram, but that doesn't matter. It can be used as a proxy for artificial intelligence. The same issues that occur here, it's identical to the way they would occur in the realm of artificial intelligence. So Compass, as we will see on the next slide just a little bit more specifically, Compass is a piece of software made by a company called Northpoint that helps determine who should receive bail and who should not receive bail. And ProPublica was looking at the decisions that the Compass algorithm was making, and they say, you can see it in their headline here, the machine bias, it's biased against blacks. That's the accusation that ProPublica is making against Compass. It's biased against this group. It's not any particular individual. It might be, if you look at these two individuals, one individual or the other might be correctly or incorrectly granted bail before they are actually facing their charges in court. But what ProPublica is saying is that in the aggregate, if you take all the blacks and all the whites, what you find is the blacks are not treated, are harmed by the algorithm because they are granted bail less frequently in a way that is unfair. That's the argument, the very famous argument that ProPublica made against Compass. And here I have just the details for you. So ProPublica is independent, nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism in the public interest. I bet I got that from their webpage. I don't know where that came from. sounds like their webpage. I think we can skip the ChatGPT, but you're free to look it up yourself just quickly right now if you want to get a different view on, or it might be the same view. I'm not sure what ChatGPT will say, but it should say something like this. And then Compass is the Correctional Offender Management Profiling for Alternative Sanctions tool. And as I said previously, it estimates the likelihood that a defendant will be arrested again based on demographic data. The defendant's race is not directly used in the calculation. So what's going on is the people are being arrested, right? So in this case, both these two people were arrested for crimes. Let's just say they were arrested for stealing cars, let's just say. Two guys are arrested on the same day on opposite sides of town for stealing cars. Come to the judge, and the judge has to make a decision about whether they will be granted bail, meaning do they go to jail or do they go home? If they are granted bail, they can put in some money and go home and then come back when it's time for their trial. And if they're found guilty of stealing the car, then presumably they go to jail. And if they're found not guilty, then they are free. All that is good for bail. The problem with if someone is not granted bail, the problem is that then they sit in jail and wait for their trial. And then if they are found not guilty, well, then they were in jail. And everyone agrees about this. This is not part of the dilemma. If someone is not granted bail and they sit in jail and then they are found not guilty of the crime, well, this is clearly unjust. You're not supposed to sit in jail for a crime you did not commit, right? Everyone agrees about that. So there is clear potential for unjust behavior here. And so it's important when you're making decisions about who gets bail and who does not get bail, that you make the best decisions possible first. And it's also important that you not be making decisions that are biased against one group or another. And this is important. We don't want people in our society to go to jail for no reason. So we want to devote resources to making sure that occurrence is minimized. And what the Compass is part of those resources, right? What Compass does is it provides data which helps judges to determine whether the bail should be granted. And I say this is high stakes because it seems to me it's high stakes. We don't want people to be going to jail for no reason. So that's what the Correctional Offender Management Profiling for Alternative Sanctions does. And then you might ask, well, how does it work? How does the Compass system work? This is how it works. This is the kind of data the Compass uses to predict recidivism, right? The possibility that the person who's been charged with the crime will go commit another crime if released on bail. These are questions that the Compass algorithm uses. These are just some of the questions. There are many questions, but these give an idea of the kinds of information that is used. So criminal history, including severity of offenses, number of past convictions, time since last offense. That makes a lot of that. That seems sensible to me, at least. I mean, if someone has never committed a crime, if someone my age has never committed a crime, and suddenly the police storm in and take me to the judge and say, look, Brousseau stole a car. And I say, no, I didn't. Look, I'm in my mid-50s. I've never stolen anything. You can check yourself. There's no record. It seems like, you know, a judge is going to say in that case, well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty possible that the police made a mistake here. I mean, he's never stolen anything before. Seems like it. Whereas by contrast, if the next person up, you know, has been stealing cars, right? Has been stealing 10 cars a year for the last 20 years, there's no guarantee, right? I mean, of course it's possible that I did steal the car and the next guy didn't. It's possible. But any reasonable judge is going to say, look, if John Jones has been stealing 10 cars a year for the last 10 years and he just got picked up again, it seems possible that, yeah, he was actually stealing the car again. And James Brousseau has never stolen a car ever and he's picked up and he insists he's innocent. You know, maybe we should give this guy the benefit of the doubt and let him do bail and go home. Makes sense, right? Of course, just one data point is never enough, but that's one data point. Demographic information, including age and gender. So people who are older, this is just factually true. If you look, people who are older tend to commit less crimes than people who are younger. Men commit more crimes than women. These are just factually true. Education and employment history. If someone has been unemployed for a long time and they're stealing food from a grocery store, you know, that tells you something. Someone who has a good job and makes plenty of money, and they say, look, I didn't steal food from the grocery store. It's true that I walked out with this thing, but it was an innocent mistake. I really didn't try to steal it. And look, you know, I have a good job. I could have paid for it easily. Well, in that case, maybe the judge would say, look, it makes sense to at least, he may be found guilty or innocent in the actual trial, but before trial, before that, at least say, okay, you can go home and come back and we'll figure it out later. Okay, substance abuse. I mean, are they high all the time? Mental health, are they insane? Insane people do commit more crimes. It's just true. Social history. These are all things, and you can add many more things to the list. These are all correspondences that exist significantly that correspond significantly with recidivism. People who are younger tend to commit crimes more than people who are older. If you have the same person, you know, exactly the same person charged with the same crime in the same circumstances, and one is younger than the other, it's more likely, simply statistically, that the young person will commit another crime than the older person. So that's what Compass does. Compass gathers up all these statistics and forms a prediction about whether or not someone will commit another crime if you send them home on bail. And that's important because judges want all the information possible, because on the one hand, we really don't want to send people to jail unjustly. Our legal system is innocent until proven guilty, and those are just empty words if it turns out that we're sending people to jail and then they later are found not guilty of crimes. So we don't want that. On the other hand, when people, you know, the citizens out there are counting on the judges and the police and so on to keep them safe from criminals. So if someone, you know, is constantly stealing cars and they come in again, it seems reasonable for the judge to say, look, I mean, I have to think about the citizenry also and the fact that you are constantly stealing cars. And so I'm going to hold you in jail until your trial. So that's the position of judges, and Compass helps them make that decision between the rights of the individual charged person who's not a criminal, but the person who's charged of being a criminal and accused of being a criminal, and the citizens out there. Now, with all that, a lot of stuff, in the background, let's look at what ProPublica was talking about. Here's what ProPublica was talking about. They went to Florida, Broward County, which is near Miami. It's a part of Miami. And they looked at everybody who was in jail, and they found, Scott, some interesting results, which you see presented here for you in graphic form. They found the following disparities between white and black. Now, before talking about this, I want to say one thing quickly. Their findings required having four sets of data points. They needed people who, white people and black people who were charged with the crime, who would commit crimes if released, and white and black people charged with the crime who would not commit crimes if released. Now, if someone is released on bail, then you can find out whether or not they would commit another crime, because they would either get arrested again or not. Or at least, I mean, it's not perfect, because sometimes you get away with crime, but just leaving the details out. You know, if someone is charged with a crime and gets released on bail and commits another crime, then they get arrested, right? So you know they shouldn't have been released on bail. But on the other side, it's problematic. Because if someone is not released on bail, if they're held in jail, you have no way of determining factually whether they would have committed another crime if released. It's called a counterfactual, right? We just have no way of knowing what would have happened. So to do this analysis, ProPublica used common statistical methods to estimate who would have and who would not have committed a crime had they been released. And they did that by looking at what happened if they were held in jail, and then they went to jail for a certain amount of time, and then they were released. Then did they commit more crimes again after that? Right. So they used that later data to go back and predict, or rather to fill in the blanks about what would have happened had they been released on bail. Now, is that perfect? No, it's not. But it's a statistical tool that people more or less accept, and that we are going to accept just for the basis of our discussion, just accept as a way of talking about this general problem. It may be that that we should look again at whether or not those and of course it's important that those approximations be correct. But for our purposes, for our theoretical purposes, we will just accept that they are correct, and so therefore we can get a data set which includes, with estimated numbers, but we will take them as true, which includes true and false positives. That is, all those who were predicted to commit another crime, who actually would have gone on to commit another crime and would not have gone on to commit another crime. And then also true and false negatives. That is, all those who were predicted to not commit another crime, who in fact would not have committed another crime or would have committed another crime. And then we have those true and false positive and true or false negative for both black and white. That's now what you see here, okay? And one more level of complication. Also what you see here are two definitions of fairness, the COMPAS definition and the ProPublica definition. Now let's look at the COMPAS definition first. This is a definition of fairness based upon the individual. What COMPAS says is that when they give someone a score of 7, that 7, which is a likelihood that the person will commit another crime, 10 being very likely, 0 being very unlikely. So I think 7 was sort of the cutoff. If they were 7 or above, then bail would not be granted, because it would appear that they would commit another crime, highly probable. So what ProPublica, what COMPAS said is, when they gave someone a 7, whether that person was black or white, man or woman, doesn't matter. If they got a 7, then the chances that they would commit another crime would be let's just say 70% or higher. When you employ that logic, what you get in jail is just what you see on the graph with the compass group. You have the people who were jailed before trial, and in that group you have some people who would have committed another crime and some people who would not have committed another crime. Again, this is where the estimates are, but let's just go with it. And you can see that between black and white, the proportions are about equal. They are because everyone is graded individually, right? The number of mistakes that are made for the black population are about the same as the number of mistakes made for the white population. And then similarly, too, for those who are recommended to be freed before trial, most of those would not have committed another crime, but some actually did. And this is true data, right? Because we know that they were caught. And here again, you see that it's more or less that it's more in that case. Also, it's the proportions are more or less the same. So you can see that what Compass says is the machine works equally well. It's fair because it works equally well for white or blacks. If it gives someone a 7, then the chance that that person will commit another crime, if they're not sent to jail, is pretty good. And it's equally, it's the same chance whether it's black or white. And you can see that clearly in the actual chart, right? It's about the same proportion of blacks and whites were fairly jailed and unnecessarily jailed and fairly freed and should not have been freed. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white. The chances that the system will work for you are the same. Stated slightly differently, the big problem, right, we said, is, well, one big problem is that people are sent to jail, but then later found to be innocent. That group is, the potential for that group is in on the right side in that lighter color, because those are people who did not, who were jailed but did not commit another crime. Now, they might have been found guilty of the crime they were charged with, but at least in the time they were jailed before then, it was unfair because they were jailed without being found guilty of a crime, and they would not have committed another crime had they gone home. So Compass stands behind what they do. They say, look, it's perfectly fair. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white. If we give you a 7, the chances are high you will commit a crime. And we gave 7s. Right? The score works equally well for black and white. ProPublica took a different position. ProPublica said we should not think in terms of individuals. Instead, we should think in terms of groups, blacks and whites. That's this group fairness part. And then they make a second decision, too. They said, we should concentrate on the worst possible scenario. And what ProPublica says is, the worst scenario is one where someone is jailed unnecessarily. That is, they are put in prison even though they would not have committed another crime. And that makes perfect sense. The first part we could talk about, but the second part makes a lot of sense. And our justice system is built upon the idea that people are innocent until proven guilty, and if they are sent to jail and they would not have committed another crime before their trial, that's clearly, everyone agrees, that's clearly unjust, right? Because they are being found guilty, they are found guilty until being found guilty or innocent, right? They're being found guilty without even facing the charges. That's clearly unfair. Now, as I say, if someone is sent to jail without being found guilty, and if had they been released, they would have committed another crime. Well, there you can say, look, you know, we've got to think about the citizens too, and we don't want them to suffer crime. So maybe the fairness for the citizens against the unfairness to the criminal, that kind of balances out. But again, the case where someone is sent to jail and they would not have committed another crime, everyone agrees that's unfair. That's a big unfair thing in our society. And that's where ProPublica focused their attention. So that's why what they say is fair is something like what occurs on the right side of this of this diagram, or what for me is, I'm not sure which side it's going to be when all this is made, but on the ProPublica side, you see that the, as against the whole population, the number of people who are unnecessarily jailed is the same, not proportionally the same, just the same for blacks and whites. And they say, we should think in terms of equality and inequality. We should think in terms of groups, not the number of blacks and whites, but just blacks and whites. And the size of that population, or the amount, the number of blacks and whites that are guilty and innocent, should be equal. The number of blacks and whites who are unnecessarily jailed, that is, they're sent to jail, denied bond, but would not have committed another crime, that number should be equal. Now, there are a lot of problems with this, but you can see how at least a mindset could be generated to think this way. If you think, one, that what really matters, the worst thing, is this being unnecessarily jailed, one. And then two, you say we're going to think not in terms of individuals, but in terms of groups. Then it follows to say, look, the groups gathered into this bad area of unnecessarily jailed, those numbers should be equal. And that's fair. Now you can see when you do that, though, what happens is, on the other side, the number of people who are released and go on to commit crimes, you can see how that falls out. The proportions do not match up there, and there are many more blacks than whites, both numerically and proportionately, who are released and then commit crimes. ProPublica did not look at that. ProPublica said, we will only look at this one side. Now, most people think that ProPublica was wrong, simply because you're not supposed to just look at one side. You're supposed to look at the whole thing. But that is their argument. And what is significant about their argument is this idea of group fairness. Right? It's the idea that we should think in terms of groups and not individuals when we talk about fairness. And then an important point here is, one of the sources of support for the ProPublica position is the idea of historical racial unfairness. ProPublica says, look, historically, racially, blacks have been treated unfairly within the justice system in Broward County, Florida. And therefore, maybe if you push them, then maybe there is this problem of those who are released. But again, ProPublica says, when you concentrate on that one area of those who are unnecessarily jailed, in that one area, given the historical background, we should make sure that blacks numerically do not suffer more than whites. So that's their notion of fairness. And if you want to see that discussion a little bit by a real computer scientist, here is you can look this up on YouTube, tutorial 21 definitions of fairness and their politics. And go to about this part, 13 minutes, 53 seconds. This is from a conference presentation. And the case that I just gave you is discussed by this computer scientist. And this person defends ProPublica. I don't think this person fully understands. He should have taken a course like this. He doesn't understand exactly what fairness is. But he manages to, I think he doesn't understand the other side of the equation, the people who are released. But he does understand this side, the recommendation jail before trial. And he does take this idea. You can see here, things look very different when analyzed from the perspective of the defendants, particularly those wrongly classified as future criminals. So he just buys that idea. He says, look, fairness should not include a consideration of those people. If we release people from jail and they go and steal from other people, we should not include the victims of those crimes in our consideration of fairness. We should only include in our consideration of fairness those people who are jailed unnecessarily. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't think he understood what he was doing. And maybe ProPublica did not understand it either. But you can, at least on the edge, make that case, right? You can say, look, in our justice system, the innocent until proven guilty is so powerful that we have to consider only that, and we cannot consider the potential unfairness that accrues if you release people from jail and they commit more crimes and cause more victims. It's too bad that there are those victims, but that's not part of the fairness calculation. Again, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And most people who look at this agree with me that this approach does not make a lot of sense, but you can make it, and it's part of what happens in the area of group fairness. Right? In group fairness, you tend to take specific groups and say, look, we're only going to pay attention to this group in this situation, and we're not going to pay attention to anything else. So he says, look, in his case, we're only going to look at the group of defendants who were wrongly classified as future criminals. And we're going to imagine fairness and impose fairness only as it applies to that group. And then in this case, he also wanted to talk about racial groups. So it's that group, people who were unfairly jailed, and racial groups. And in that way, he comes out, at least, I'm not sure if he fully would support ProPublica, but he comes out as kind of aligned with their way of thinking about things. So to wrap this idea of group, we'll come to that, but to wrap this idea of group fairness up, what group fairness means is that instead of considering the entire population of people as individuals, as Compass did, and considering their entire range of their behaviors, like they commit crimes now or don't commit crimes and include the victims and so on, Compass tried to include everyone in their discussion of fairness. People who defend group fairness, they cut out large parts of experience and say, we're only going to consider some people and how they are treated, and we're only going to consider that in certain situations. And they tend to do that in ways that have to do with the legal groupings of fairness in terms of gender and race and so on, and combined, in this case, they combined it with questions about whether or not people are unnecessarily jailed. So group versus individual fairness is basically the idea when you're doing AI ethics and doing things like using AI to decide who gets bail and who does not. If you work from the perspective of individual fairness, what you will do is you will try to account for everyone in the whole universe of action, including criminals, including victims, and so on. By contrast, what you will do if you're going to work in group fairness is you will surgically remove a small group and say, look, we're only going to talk about this group in this situation and make sure that fairness exists there. And in this case, you see it clearly. They said, look, we're only going to talk about those who are unnecessarily jailed, and we're going to make sure that blacks and whites are equally represented there. Not proportionally, equally. Okay, it's a different way of thinking about these things. Now, a lot of this has to do with, I think, one thing that this person was confused about has something to do with something called Simpson's paradox. Simpson's paradox is a kind of confusion that arises from proportions. Here's a famous example. It's from 1973, and there is a question. This is about men and women and whether or not there is some kind of discrimination going on here. And we're looking at departments. So department A is, let's say that's philosophy. B would be sociology. C is psychology. D is law, whatever. It doesn't matter. So you're looking at departments, and you're looking at the applicants and the percentage admitted. And what you're trying to do here is figure out whether or not Berkeley, Cal Berkeley, is treating men and women fairly. So let's take a quick look. At Department A, let's just say it's philosophy. 62% of men and 82% of women were admitted. Department of B, 63% of men and 68% of women. So in philosophy and sociology, more women than men. But then in psychology, 37% of men were admitted and only 34% of women. So that slight edge for men. In the next department, 33 and 35, slight edge for women. Then in this department, 28 and 24, slight edge for men. So you see, this is a slight edge for men, slight edge for women, slight edge for men. But here, 63 versus 68, I guess that's slight edge for women. So these are all kind of canceling out. The big difference is here, 62% versus 82%. So it looks like here, maybe California Berkeley is slightly biased toward women, or maybe men would have some claim to say, well, wait a minute, the admissions at Cal Berkeley are biased against men, because it looks like slightly women get women get admitted more than men. Okay, now let's see the totals here at the bottom. The totals are quite surprising. It turns out, after we saw from this provisional look, it looked like women were admitted more than men. When you total it up, in fact, it's the opposite. Men are admitted at far higher rates than women. Interesting, right? And it's a significant difference, 45 versus 30%. How can this be? How can it be that when you look at the individual departments, it's like women by a lot, women by a little, men by a little, women by a little, men by a little, women by a little, as a tie, women by a little. So it sounds, it looks like it's women are better off, but then the results are men by a lot. How did that happen? Well, the way that happened is that if you look at the number of applicants in Department A, which had a very high admissions percentage, 62% for men versus these others, which are 6%, 28%, 38%, 34%, 35%. In the department which had the easiest admissions, and the largest number of admissions, women did a lot better than men. Wait, so this is not right. See, this is one thing where I say if I was doing this as a job interview, I would cut the recording here and try and figure out what is going on. It's the opposite. Okay, right. So you see what's going on. In places where the admissions are relatively easy, a lot of guys applied. So it's true, for example, in Department A, that women were admitted at a far higher percentage than men. It's true. But a lot more guys applied. 800 versus 100. So that's eight times, roughly, the number of men applied as women. So even though women were admitted at a far higher percentage, there's going to be a lot more guys admitted. And then if you go down here and look at, say, this letter E, only 191 guys applied, but a lot of women applied. So 200 versus almost 400, almost twice as many women applied. But this Department E is a lot harder to get into. Look, that's only 28% admissions. So when the departments are difficult, it seems like when it's hard to get in, women are applying more than men. Here again, you see this in letter C. A lot of women are applying. Men, 325, women, 600. Men are slightly more, but what is more significant than that is it's hard to get in here. Whereas in the 62-63%, 82-68, in the departments that it's easy to get into, men are applying a lot more. So the result of all that is, because men apply a lot more to the departments which are easy to get into, even though more women got in those departments, overall, for the whole university, more men got in than women. So it's really weird. And if you look at just, and I wish I had another slide where I just showed only the total. If you look at just the totals at Cal Berkeley, it looks like it's biased in favor of men. Clearly, 45% versus 30%. But admissions. But if you get rid of the totals and look department by department, it's the opposite. It looks like women actually is slightly biased in favor of women. So I call this proportion confusion because it's really difficult to figure out fair treatment when you have different proportions in consideration. And the different proportions that we are considering here are proportions of people admitted in different departments. In departments A and B, we have 60 to 80% admissions. That's one proportion, which is really different than Department F, which is 6 and 7% admission. So there's a double thing you need to keep track of. Who is admitted more, men or women, and how many people are applying and are admitted anyway. And those two things can sort of work against each other and give a different perception. As I say, from this perception, it looks like Berkeley favors women and disfavors men. Whereas from this perception, it looks like Berkeley favors men and disfavors women. Which is it? Hard to know. Hard to know. And anyway, in any case, the last point is, when you are doing fairness in terms of groups, whether it's racial groups or gender groups or any other group, you are prone to difficulties just like this. You are prone to difficulties because you can have these proportion confusions, right? When you have different proportions of people applying to one department or another, or in jail or out of jail, it can create the appearance that one group is being discriminated against or another. But then when you change the proportions, when you change the sample set, are we talking about one department or all the departments together? Then it creates the opposite perception. And there's no way to tell necessarily if you're going to do group fairness. There's no way to tell necessarily, you know, which one is right. Should we say that Berkeley is biased in favor of women? You can make an argument. Or should we say Berkeley is biased in favor of men? You can make an argument. Whereas by contrast, that's the problem with group fairness. When you just do individuals, it's much easier. You just say, look, here's individual A and individual B, and we will have both individuals apply to the same department A, let's say. And the only difference is, these will be false applications. The only difference will be one is Jane Jones and one is John Jones. Right? And so in that way, if you just do it on the individual level, you can check and see, are they both admitted or both rejected or one or the other? Right? That would tell you something on the individual level. So individual level, you have, it's much easier to test for fairness. But when you start talking about groups, things can become very, very complicated, as you see here. Okay, so from what I've said so far, I've defined what group fairness is, and I've said that it doesn't look like a very good idea. It seems like it doesn't work very well for fairness. Now we're going to go do individual fairness. And to do a spoiler alert, we're going to have the same conclusion. It doesn't work very well. So both individual and group fairness are going to have problems. And that's what we're learning in this class, like what fairness is sort of through the fairness problems. And working with this stuff in artificial intelligence is a never-ending knot of difficulty. All right, so individual fairness. We will stop for a moment and have you consider the ProPublica Encompass debate and think a little bit about whether or not you side with ProPublica or Compass. And then we can move on and talk about individual fairness. Okay. Our case for individual fairness as against group fairness is going to focus on an insurance company called Lemonade. They solve fairness problems, and fairness problems are the ones we've seen this entire way through. Skin cancer and breast cancer and who goes to jail and who goes home and all that stuff, and genders, males and female, and race, black and white, and so on. They solve all that mess by saying, look, we're going to go for radical individuality. Instead of balancing collective differences, we are going to distribute for individual characteristics, meaning we are just not going to consider whether or not blacks or whites or men and women, how they as a group are affected by our insurance. Specifically, they're going to be talking in this case about religion. So it's Jews and Gentiles in this case. But it's the same thing. Black, white, Jews, Gentile, male, female, et cetera. Doesn't matter. What they're going to say is, look, the solution, I'm not sure it's a good solution, but the solution, and it does solve some problems. The solution to the problems we have been looking at up to now is radical individuality. Just get rid of all group considerations. No, we don't even worry about people are male or female or black or white or Jews or Gentiles. We only care about each individual and how he or she is treated. And what they say, this is from Lemonade's own blog, what they say is the history of insurance it goes in three phases. One, the first phase is that everyone just gets the same rate, right? So when you're buying insurance, let's say you're buying insurance for your apartment, everyone who owns an apartment pays the same insurance rate. In the second set, in the second idea, the second stage, people's rates depend upon on groups, right? And so here you might be thinking of maybe geographic groups. So people whose apartments are right next to the ocean, their insurance rates are higher because the possibility of hurricanes is higher, and that will come through and blow out everything in the apartment. And so insurance will have to replace all the furniture and things. So in level two, instead of everyone paying the same amount, people are broken up into groups. And as I say, in the case of insurance, one group might be people who live on the coast versus people who live inland. And the people on the coast pay more for renter's insurance than the people inland. And the reason they do is because the people on the coast are more likely to suffer from hurricane damage and so more likely to need to collect on the insurance. In step three, and this is what Lemonade is about, this is what the company serves to exist to serve this ideal. In level three, artificial intelligence, according to Lemonade, will allow for insurance charges to be distributed on the individual level. And that, as I say, is going to erase all of the problems we have been seeing up to now in this session. Okay, so radical individuality. We don't care anymore about groups. Don't care about men and women, live on the coast, not live on the coast, age, religion, none of that stuff matters. Just you as an individual. And then, so for just very quickly, I think I've given most of this background now, but so background, Lemonade is an insurance company. They're based here in New York City. What they specialize in is New York City kind of things like renter's insurance. So people who are renting an apartment do not need to insure the building. Like if something happens to the building, they don't care since they don't own it. But if something happens to the building, it might ruin their sofa and destroy their TV. So they do want insurance for that. And so what Lemonade offers is that kind of insurance, insurance for apartments. I think they also have insurance for pets and some other things. But renter's insurance is their main focus. It's where they try to use artificial intelligence to create insurance premiums which are performed better. Right? People pay less and get better service. That's the idea. And they do it with artificial intelligence. That's their business. Okay. So this is from the blog, the same blog from which this picture came, which describes this idea of radical individuality in insurance. Here's the textual argument. So this is a blog entry from the company, and this is the company CEO whose name is escaping me. But he says, let's say I'm Jewish. I am. The guy who owns the company is, in fact, Jewish. And my tradition involves lighting candles every Friday. People like me represent a higher risk of fire than the national average. Makes sense. If AI charges Jews, on average, more than others for fire insurance, is that unfair? Yes, if being Jewish resulted in higher premiums. That, though, is a phase two problem, right? So in phase two, that's where you divide up into groups. And you could imagine people saying, oh, look, Jews light a lot of candles, so they've got a lot of fires, so their insurance rates go up. So we're going to charge all Jews a higher rate than Gentiles. I'm a Gentile, a non-Jew. Right? So for me, sounds good to me. I get the same insurance deal for a lower premium. But someone who's Jewish says, wait a minute, unfair. You know, I'm getting the same deal as Brousseau, but I'm paying more for it. Right? And in the law also, those kinds of distinctions, you're not supposed to make those kinds of distinctions in terms of religion or race or gender. Though there are exceptions. I think that, I guess I'm not sure. I think you're not, well, you're not supposed to make distinctions in terms of age, but I think for driving insurance, I think there's a cutout in the law in most places that allow for insurance companies to charge young drivers higher premiums than older drivers. Why? Because younger drivers have more accidents. Makes sense. But that's, other people will say, well, you shouldn't be charging younger people more money for the same insurance as you charge me. That's unfair. And whether you agree or disagree with that, that debate is a level two debate. That's a debate about groups and fairness and how different groups are treated, young and old, Jews and Gentiles, men and women, etc. Going back to Lemonade, the solution they propose is a phase three algorithm, which identifies proclivity, people's proclivity for candle lighting, and charges them more for that risk. This is fair. He says, look, what we are going to charge people for is not only, but one of the things we will raise their raise up the cost for is how much they're lighting candles. And he adds, the fact that fondness for candles is concentrated among Jews means that on average, Jews will pay more. It does not mean that people are charged more for being Jewish, which is another way of saying it could happen. I mean, there certainly are Jewish people who don't like candles, right? Maybe a lot of Jewish people are using a lot of candles, true, but there are, certainly are some Jews out there who are not lighting candles ever. They say, I don't want candles, no candles for me. What he says, what Lemonade says is, what makes our system work is that we will identify those particular Jews who are not lighting candles, and we're going to give them the same deal as we give Brousseau, who also does not light candles. But all those many other Jews who are lighting candles a lot, they get the bad deal. They get charged more for their insurance. And when you're looking at that from a distance, what you're going to see is, according to the Lemonade guy, what you're going to see is it looks like Jews are being charged more than Gentiles for lighting candles. That's what it looks like. But it's not true. Let me go back again. It looks like Jews are being charged more than Gentiles for their apartment renter's insurance. But it's not true. People who are lighting candles are being charged more. Not Jews. And lighting candles is an individual choice that you make regardless of what particular religious group you happen to belong to. Now, it may be, as he says, look, as it turns out, a lot of Jews are lighting candles. So it looks like Jews are getting a bad deal from Lemonade. And the guy, again, the guy who owns it is Jewish. So, but he says, that's not really what's happening. What's happening is, every individual in AI has the power to get the data to arrange this. Every individual is being charged for their personal risk. Now, so it goes beyond candles, obviously, right? So what Lemonade would do is they would say, look, instead of charging you the same rate, there are three possibilities. First is Lemonade can say, you own an apartment in New York City? Great. The charge for you monthly for renter's insurance will be $100. Or Lemonade could say, you know what, we're going to go down into groups. And we're going to say that those people who own an apartment in New York City near the ocean, they're going to pay $120 a month. And the people who are inland, they will pay $100 a month. So now you have groups. That's the level two. The level three is, we are going to look at every single apartment individually and ask, what is the risk that items, the sofas, the television in that department will require insurance expenditure? That is, what are the chances that the sofa in that apartment will have to be replaced? Maybe it will be a hurricane that waterlogs it and ruins it. Maybe it will be a theft. Maybe it will be a fire because someone's candle dropped and started the place on fire. All of those factors, or this is what Lemonade seeks. Lemonade seeks to take account of all of those factors and create a risk profile for that one apartment so that everyone pays specifically for the amount of risk that they have. So no one is charged anything extra for being Jewish, because being Jewish, it doesn't make any difference. But if you happen to light candles a lot, now you're in trouble. Now you have to pay extra. Just like someone would say, if you live near the coast, you would pay extra. So that's the Lemonade argument for individuality. They say, we no longer need to worry about whether legally protected groups are being treated fairly or unfairly. And we no longer need to worry about groups in general, whether it's legally protected or not, men or women or Jews and Gentiles or tall or short or people with curly hair or straight hair. None of it makes any difference anymore. There is no group consideration in fairness. And we should never be measuring, according to this logic, we should never be measuring how well the insurance functions for one group against another, because that doesn't matter. We should only be measuring how well the AI insurance allows us to accurately represent the true risk that, let's say, James Brousseau represents and charges him the insurance premium that corresponds with that risk. And we don't compare it with anyone else except on that single measure, which is called a loss ratio. That is, for insurance to work, they have to make money, right? So the chances for every $100 that I pay them in premiums, what has to work out over the long term is that they would pay in compensation for fire damage or so on. They would pay, I'm just making this up, but they would pay 90 cents. So they have a 10 cent profit on their, in their business. Otherwise they go out of business, right? But the main idea for artificial intelligence is this sense that what AI does is it equalizes insurance risk, in this case, equalizes insurance risk radically on the individual. And that's only possible with the kind of information technology, big data resources, and big data tools that we have today. It's going to allow us to say that every individual should exist with more or less the same loss ratio. That is, everyone should be paying in money, in premium, a little bit above what the actual cost is of their risk. So if, as I say, if the actual prediction is that I will cost the company $900 in damages over the course of my time with them, then they have to make sure they collect $1,000 in premium. Now this, it should be noted, this is the exact same logic that Compass used in the Compass ProPublica case. That's what Compass said. Compass said we should evaluate, we should predict the degree to which the likelihood that someone will go to jail on the individual level. We don't make a prediction for all blacks or all young blacks or all whites or something like that. We look at every individual and give that person a score. And when we give that person a score, say a 7, the chances that that person, individual, will commit a crime is, let's just say, 70%. And it doesn't matter whether they're black or white or what have you. It's only on the level of the individual. That same mentality that the North Point Compass people had, that's the same mentality that's working here in insurance. Everyone pays a little bit more in insurance premium than their actual risk. And then what happens in the real world, right? What happens in the real world is some people's apartments and some people end up needing a big payoff because they get insurance for 1 month and then a fire, candle tips, and everything burns out. So they only paid insurance for 1 month, $100, but now they get a $1,000 claim for their ruined furniture. Whereas other people, they pay for year after year, but nothing ever happens. So they had the insurance for no reason. Overall, the whole thing works out. If the insurance company is doing it correctly, it works out so the company makes a profit. But again, what's important for Lemonade is this idea that the risk evaluation is attached radically to each individual. It's not about a group. You're not charged more or less for being a Jewish or non-Jewish. You are charged more or less for your individual choice of burning candles. And I guess to make it really work, you need to be charged a little bit more, right, for each extra candle you burn over the course of a year, right? So maybe they give you 10 free candle burnings for birthdays and such, but then starting with the 11th candle you burn, you pay a little more than 12th, 13th, 14th, something like that. So that's the positive case for Lemonade. It does solve the group fairness problem, right? When people say, look, that a certain group, like Jews in this case, are being treated unfairly by the insurance company because Jews as a group are paying more for insurance than Gentiles like me, that seems unfair. What he responds is, it's not fair or unfair. It doesn't matter. No one is being charged more or less for being Jewish. Instead, everyone is being charged only in terms of their personal risk. And they control that entirely. You could decide or not decide to use candles. If you decide to use less candles, then your premium will go down, right? The insurance rate will drop. We've already seen that in this question when we talked about autonomy, the question of dynamic insurance, and this idea that the insurance company traces you and goes around with you. And we see that clearly in car insurance now, where people can plug in an AI monitor into their car and feed this data to the car insurance company. Well, what the car insurance company is doing is they're saying, look, we're going to charge you individually for your risk. If you're a better driver, your premium goes down. That's the same thing he is saying, this Lemonade guy is saying, for housing insurance. I'm just going to charge you as a person. You're in control. If you want lower premiums, burn less candles. Up to you. If you want to burn more candles, great, and be my guest. But if you do that, then you have to pay higher insurance premiums. Okay, so that's the strong case for individual fairness. But there's a problem. And I think if you just think about it for a second, it's clear what the problem is. The whole idea of insurance is that you share risk. Right? I mean, that's why we have it. Some people, for example, some people are more prone to accidents, health accidents, breaking a leg, than other people. As it happens, I myself have never broken a leg or an arm or anything. So I'm lucky, but I've been paying health insurance all this time and not using it. Now, that perturbs me a little bit because health insurance is very expensive, but that's kind of the way insurance is supposed to work. That's the way we live together as a society. We all pay in a little bit and then constantly. And then when something bad happens, that money flows to the person who had the bad luck of breaking their arm or their leg. Now, it might happen, and I think it does from my sort of experience. It seems like some people have worse luck than others at breaking their arms and legs. And maybe we would say, like someone like this, like the Lemonade person would say, look, Brousseau, you never break an arm and a leg. So you know what? I'm going to bring your insurance costs down. Now, that sounds good to me. But doesn't that, again, ruin the point? I mean, isn't the point of insurance that we all do something together to help us all live together more safely? It's true, some people get shafted, some people get a better benefit. I'm one of the ones who's gotten shafted on broken limbs so far. But that's why we have insurance. That was part of the deal. When all of this started, And when I first got my first insurance policy, I didn't know that. I mean, it could have happened perfectly well that maybe I would have a few car accidents and break a few bones, and I would have been one of the ones who needed to get out of the health insurance kitty, right, the health insurance distribution, more than I put in. I didn't know beforehand. And because I had insurance, right, I lived better during all those years. I knew I didn't have to, well, I didn't want to break any bones, but I knew that at least if I did, I could go to the hospital and it would be taken care of. Now, all these years later on, I mean, if I could go back in time, right, would I have been better off to just say, forget insurance, not going to pay it? Yep, I would have. I would be a lot better off. But that's not what insurance is. Insurance is supposed to be a way that we pool our risk so that all of us live better together. It seems to me that what the fairness guy is doing is he's saying, look, we're going to use AI to predict very well that Brousseau, guess what? Good news for you. You're probably not going to break any bones. This is what the data tells us. So you pay a very little health insurance premium. I say, great. But the person who's predicted to break a lot of bones, and maybe does break a lot of bones, you know, their health insurance premiums are going to be almost as much as the cost of their health care. Mm-hmm. And again, doesn't that ruin the whole point? I mean, isn't the point, going back to the start, that we pool our risk as a group and we live together as a group better? Because we share this risk together? I mean, isn't that why it all got started? I mean, in some sense, it seems to me that you can make the case that the fairest insurance is not the one that's most personalized, where every one of us as individuals pays precisely the amount of risk that we represent. So I pay less insurance for breaking a bone, but I pay more insurance for skin cancer. Right, because I'm as a light-skinned person, I'm highly vulnerable to skin cancer. It seems like you could make the case that instead of all of those fine little distinctions, maybe we're better off with, for some, maybe it's fair, not better off, maybe it's fairer to say that what we should do is just have everyone pay the same amount for health insurance, and then everyone gets the same benefit out. Maybe health insurance is one of those areas where instead of going for radical individualism, we should go for the radical group, meaning we're all part of one single group. We all pay the same amount. We all get the same potential benefit, even though some individuals end up collecting more and some less. I don't know. That's a decision you will have to make. What I wanted to do is define for you what group fairness is and what individual fairness is, and then say that, look, the reason we debate these two things is because it's not necessarily clear which one is more fair. People argue for one side or argue for the other, but strong arguments can be made for both sides. And it could be that in the world of artificial intelligence, we should lean toward group fairness, understanding how people are treated in terms of the groups in which we associate them. And maybe the group is just one big group, everyone, or maybe it's racial groups or age groups or something else on one side. Or maybe it is that with this new technology of data and algorithms and big data, the harvesting of big data about everyone, maybe it is that in this new era, the fairest thing to do will be to tilt toward radical individualism in insurance and in other ways, in predictions about jail and so on. It is not clear, but why don't you take 5 minutes to think about this question about whether insurance should be about individuals or groups, and if about groups, should it be one group or many groups, and what the groups should be, and maybe if it's different for health insurance and for jobs. There's a lot to think about there, but just take some time to kind of think for yourself about some of those questions and kind of outline some of those thoughts. Okay, so we have remaining the fairness and privacy dilemma, which is not going to be very long. Representational versus distributive fairness is a little bit longer, and blindness and insight, which will be very quick. Actually, we skipped that slide of the fairness and privacy dilemma. But I can just tell you what it is. I'm not sure where the slide went. But I will tell you what the fairness and privacy dilemma is. In order to be fair, write this down on the privacy and fairness slide. Fairness plus privacy slide. I'll fill that in. Or maybe I won't, because actually it's just easy just to explain. Let me just explain it. It's really straightforward and simple. Fairness is the idea that people will be treated equally within the decision domain. So let's say that we are trying to hire lawyers. I think all of us can agree that, let's just say, religion and skin color and gender, there's three characteristics: religion, skin color, and gender. Those three things should not be considered when you are hiring a lawyer. Whereas things that should be considered are, do they have a law degree? What was their GPA? How much experience do they have? Those kinds of things should be considered. Now, the fairness and privacy dilemma is, if we want to make fair decisions, and we want to be certain the decisions are fair when we are hiring lawyers, let's say, then in order to evaluate that, in order to know whether or not the AI is making fair decisions, then we need to look at all of the applicants and all of those who are ultimately hired, and we need to know what their religion is, what their gender is, what their race is, and other things too. In other words, to be fair to people, we need to know a lot about them. But wait a minute. We've already said in this seminar that privacy is a significant ethical value, and people want to maintain control over the information they give of themselves. And most people don't want others to know all the things about them, what their religion is, what their gender and race is, and maybe other more personal things. But what matters for our purposes here is that if we are going to be certain that we are fair, then we must force people to divulge this information about themselves: gender, race, color, age, all that other stuff. We see this actually in many hiring things. They do ask at the end, in hiring things, in many kinds of forms that we fill out, they ask at the end about our race and age and so on. And sometimes it will say, these are voluntary questions. Which is fine. That's protecting people's privacy. It's up to you to decide if you want to share that information. That's great. But the point we are trying to make here is, within the question of fairness, is that if you want to be sure that there's fairness, then you are going to need to violate people's privacy. You are going to have to say that those questions are not optional. We have to know, what is your gender? What is your age? What is your religion? And on the list goes, in order to ensure that the machine is treating you fairly in those ways, so that we can go and look, now that we've determined, because we forced everyone to tell us how old they are, look, we have found that this hiring algorithm, and this is actually a true case, just came across my desk the other day, this hiring algorithm, for some reason, is not hiring anyone older than 55 years old. That unfair, and that seems unfair. It seemed unfair in this case. But that could only be discovered because the people who applied for the post, a requirement was made that they reveal how old they are. If people had not revealed how old they are, there would have been no way of knowing that the machine was not hiring people who are older than 55. So fairness is not free. If you're going to insist on fairness in artificial intelligence and information in technology, and if you want to be serious about it, then you are going to have to violate people's privacy. Now, in the real world, what most people do is we try and kind of split the difference. We say, look, I mean, hopefully enough people will voluntarily provide information about themselves, their gender, age, and so on, for us to then look at the results of artificial intelligence processes and draw pretty decent conclusions about whether or not they are fair. I mean, are these machines arbitrarily cutting off consideration of people who are older than 55? We don't want that. That's unfair. And if enough people have decided to voluntarily share with us their age, then we can probably find that out. That's in the real world, we try to do that, right? We try and kind of split the difference. We try to save privacy and save fairness by making this information voluntary. And if it works, it works. But if it doesn't work, if people are not providing their information, then you have to make a decision. Are you going to be all in on fairness? If so, you're going to have to violate privacy and get the age and gender and race and all that stuff of people. Or are you going to be all in on privacy? You're going to let people just keep themselves their information when they send in their digital application. And then the results just come out and person A gets an interview and person B doesn't and person C does and person D, E doesn't. If you're going to be a privacy person and insist that that's the way to do things, then you're going to have no way to figure out, or no good way to certainly figure out or confidently figure out whether or not the machine is treating people fairly. Because you won't have any way to know, to look and see, oh, wait a minute, you know, people older than 55 are not getting interviews. So you have to make the fairness and privacy dilemma is this idea that you need to make a decision about which of those two is worth more, theoretically. In practice, that's the dilemma. You've got to decide one or the other. In practice, as I say, what we do in the real world is we try to get, what is it called? Get your cake and eat it too. We try to get both by making questions about your gender and age and so on voluntary. And the hope is enough people with control over access to their personal information grant that access, and so we can check and see. But the fact that people do that in the real world doesn't change the fact that theoretically the dilemma does exist, and it's always there, it's always latent. Which one is more important to you, privacy or fairness? And then if I had the slides, I would say that we should stop here for a few minutes too and have you think just quickly about which one of those two is worth more. That done, however, we are going to move on to the last big deal of discussion in the area of AI fairness. And that is the idea of representational fairness. Up to now, we have been talking about distributive fairness. That is the way some social benefit is distributed. In the case of skin cancer, we were talking about healthcare AI capacities. Like, how is that distributed? Are these capacities distributed in terms of people's vulnerability? That is, higher vulnerability equals you get the higher level of quality treatment, and lower vulnerability equals lower treatment. Or should the treatment levels be distributed in terms of race, where we say, look, regardless of your race, you should get an equal level of accuracy in your AI diagnostic treatment. And we've seen the same thing in terms of men and women in breast cancer, right? Same distinction. Should we distribute mammograms equally to men and women? For every 5 men who get a mammogram, 5 women get it. Or should we distribute it in terms of vulnerability? Because women are 100 times more vulnerable than men. For every 1 man that gets the mammogram, 99 women will get the mammogram. How should these benefits be distributed? That's distributive fairness. Representational fairness is a little bit different. Representation is not the opportunities or the social goods that are actually given out to people. In some sense, as the term indicates, it's the representation of an opportunity to get a social good. And a classic case comes from 2018, kind of the, it's almost the foundational case for the idea of representational fairness. It comes from the Google search, just the Google search engine. The Google CEO search means you just type the word CEO into the Google search engine, hit return, and then hit images. And what comes up? Well, what comes up is this picture you see in front of you. You might notice that a lot and a lot and a lot of, and I'm just kind of looking at it, all of them that I'm seeing are white men, maybe an Asian or two, but all of them that I'm seeing are white men, except one female, which is down here in the corner. That's not even a person. That's Barbie. Right. So, you have clearly here, a sense that if someone is going to be looking at this, representation of what it means to CEO, to be a CEO, and you are a white guy like me, you're going to say, oh yeah, so that's what a CEO looks like. Yeah, I've got a pretty good chance to be a CEO. I guess I will go for that job. But proponents of representational fairness, what they say is, well, wait a minute now, hold on. What if you are a woman and you don't want to be a Barbie doll? You want to be a CEO. I mean, it makes it look like you really don't have that opportunity. When in fact, of course, women do have that opportunity. So the idea of representational fairness is the idea that when we do something like a Google search for CEOs, that search should yield results which are representative of the population, men, which includes, last time I checked, includes men and women, includes blacks and whites, includes old and young, Jews and Gentiles, and these are just some of the groups we've been talking about here, and there are many other groups. That group of people who are shown as CEOs should reflect that population, so there should be some representatives of those people here on this the screen that you are looking at now, as opposed to what you do see. And I see there's one black guy here hidden underneath the word fairness and versus ethical fairness. So there's one black guy, one woman, and all white guys. The argument for representational fairness is that there should be a distribution of genders and ages and colors and so on. Now, there are two questions here. One is a theoretical question, and the other is a practical question. The theoretical question is, well, wait a minute, someone might say. In fact, if you look at the most important CEOs in the country, they are overwhelmingly white males. So this Google search, it does report the mathematical truth. And then the next question is, do we really want to misrepresent reality? Now, if we put 50% women, 50% men, 50% black, 50% white, or whatever it is, do we really want to misrepresent reality in order to achieve this representational fairness? Which one is worth more, the accuracy or the truth, or the fairness and the opportunity? Hard to know, right? So that's one question. That's a very theoretical question. But then there's also a practical question. Let's say that we decide we're going to go for the representational route. And we're going to say, and I know the facts I'm going to say right now are not exactly true, but just go with it as an example. We are going to say that it is true, actually, or mathematically, that this is what the most important CEOs look like. But we want to have a representative sample so that our daughters, as well as our sons, and different races and religions and so on, all think that they too can be CEOs. Okay, great. That makes a lot of sense. You can make that claim clearly underneath the ethics of fairness. But then there's a practical question, and well, how many of what do we put? So you say, all right, let's look at our society. I guess it's about 50-50 male-female. So what do we do? Half should be men, half should be women. And what about race? Well, it's about this much black, white, Hispanic, Asian. Okay, makes sense. So now we've got 50-50 men, women, whatever the percentages are, 10% black, 10% Asian, 10% Hispanic, and 70% white. Okay, I don't know what they are, but just say that's what it is. We got that in there. Makes sense so far. We're doing well. But then there's the question, well, where do we stop? Because someone like me will say, okay, now I want to make sure that we have the fair share of people who are 50 or older. So we've got it broken up in terms of men and women and different races. And now we have to also add in a certain percentage, 30% are over 50 and 70% are under 50. Wait a minute. What about people who are Jews versus Protestants versus Catholics versus Islam versus some other religions that you could add? Okay. Well, now we've got this percent, this percent, this percent, this percent. We can keep, you see this keeps going. And we only have how many windows here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times 1, 2, 3. So say about 70 windows, more or less. If we've only got 70 windows, we're going to pretty quickly run out of space to represent all the things that we want represented. So the idea that you are going to opt for representational fairness, that makes a lot of sense, but that doesn't just solve the problem. Now, if you want to go that route, you've opened up a lot of other problems for yourself that you're going to have to deal with. Namely, who gets represented and to what degree? People who are against representational fairness, not because they're in favor of a different kind of fairness, but instead because they want to privilege truth and accuracy over fairness. They just say, look, the claim would be kind of a dignity claim. Humans have, as part of their human dignity, they have a right to be have the world represented to them in a way that is true. When I Google CEO, I want to see the CEOs from the biggest companies. And that's just a dignity consideration. I, as a human being, have a right to expect truth. So people who want to defend that position, right, they say, look, I can defend that theoretically, but also practically. It's just a lot easier to, when someone types in CEO, just give them whatever this was, 70 CEOs of the 70 biggest companies. Or it would really be the 70 CEOs who most commonly appear on the internet, because that's what the Google searches, right? It just searches the internet and finds, well, look, here is, I'm trying to find someone I know here. This is the guy from Microsoft. Oh, there's the Facebook guy, Zuckerberg. So he appears on the internet a lot. He is a CEO. And so what Google does is it just gets the CEOs who appear most on the internet. And this represents some level of truth about who are CEOs out in the world. And then there's that dignity argument. So people who make that argument say, look, there's the dignity argument, theoretical argument in favor of this composition. But also practically, it's just a lot easier. Right? Just find the CEOs who are most common on the internet, throw them up there, and you're good. The fact that it's practically easy doesn't mean it's ethically right. Of course not. But it is an argument. If you're going to take the representational route, it's not sufficient just to say that you want a representative view of who CEOs could be. You have to be able to say what that representation is. What is it based on? Why is it 50% men and 50% women? That's an easy one. It's 50-50 because that's more or less what the population is. But later on, eventually, you're going to get to the point where someone is going to say, why is there no one represented who is above 50 and above 6 feet tall and has curly hair? And you're going to say, well, look, we can't represent everyone. Yeah, but you have to give a reason for that. So the question of representational fairness is both a theoretical and a practical question. Now, of course, the practical argument in favor of representational fairness is obvious. Just looking at this and sticking with this, sticking with the most simple case, this is all men. Many people have daughters. Anyone who has a daughter and who thinks that CEO is a good job, as a quick footnote, it might be the CEO with all this stress and stuff is a bad job. Maybe you don't want that. But let's just take for the case that, you do want that. I mean, anyone who has a daughter, which is what, like half the parents, right? And that's the practical case. Half the parents are going to say, I want my daughter to have the same chances as my son. So that's the strong argument in favor of representational fairness, right? That the opportunities as we see them, opportunities should not just be distributed equally, but the possibility or the idea that the potential is there for them, that too, that representation of the possibility, that too should be distributed equally. And as I say, it's just a very strong argument, you know, for anyone who would have, for anyone who's a parent or anyone who has a brother or a sister, right? Unless you really don't like your sister or something, right? But for anyone that's in a family where there are boys and girls, the case for representational fairness when it comes to the CEO search is going to be just very obvious. But as I say, the fact that it's obvious doesn't mean it wins, because it has a lot of problems. It means you're giving up truth, and then you've got to deal with all these practical problems. Another a common example of the representational fairness case is translation of things from translation from one language to another. In many of the Romance languages, you may know if you've studied, nouns are gendered. So if you have a nurse in English, if I tell you, oh, there's a nurse over there, you don't necessarily know whether that is a man or a woman. But in Spanish and Italian, infermiere, that's the Italian, if I pronounce it right. When you say nurse, right, you are saying, because of the gender of the noun, you are saying it's a male nurse or a female nurse. So it's curious. So if you have a book which is written in Italian, do you try, and the word is in the Italian, it's infermiere, it's a male nurse. Do you translate that as male nurse or just nurse? Or going the other way, if in the English you're translating English word nurse into Italian, you have to translate it. That's the problem with Italian and Spanish. You have to translate it as woman or man. Well, how do you translate it? Anyone who's been to a hospital knows that there more nurses are women than men. So do you translate it that way? Do you just say, look, there are more female than male nurses, so when I translate nurse from English to Italian, I translate as infermiera, which is the female? Or instead, do I say, in a hospital, 80% are women and 20% are men? So then when you translate the literature, do you translate it 80% of the times one way and 20% the other? Or do you say, look, I want to go in full representational fairness. I want to say for every job out there, it's translated or represented half the time as male and half the time as female. You can say that too. You can defend that case. But all of those cases, right, are imperfect. Again, mainly because it's hard to know exactly where, on the one hand, it's hard to know exactly where to draw the line. Like, how many times should I translate as female? How many times as male? One side, and then on the other side, there's this worry that it's just, you're just lying to people, right? If you're going to make it 50-50 men and women, then you go into the hospital and you look and you say, no, it's not 50-50. It just isn't. So those are the two concerns about statistical fairness. It's not true. And then there's a practical decision about where you draw the lines. Good. And then so the practical question, and I'm posing it here, is, okay, well, what should Google do? I mean, here's a real case. This is from 2018. Google's CEO search produced this image. It wasn't something they did intentionally, right? Their CEO search simply produced the list of CEOs that were most common on the internet. No one even thought about it. And certainly, everyone agrees, no one at Google was like trying to say, we're going to discriminate against women. We don't want women CEOs. No, it wasn't like that. This is just what came up. But once it came up, once it was apparent, then you have to ask, should we do something about it? And if we do, what? And so I say that there, again, here, there are the two, there are the two questions, right? That are we willing to exchange? What are we willing to exchange for this fairness? Are we willing to not tell people the truth? And to what degree will we do that? So that the question about representational fairness is a real question that Google faced. And by the way, you can check for yourself. If you just right now go away, surf away from this page and go to Google and search CEO, what you will find is they set it up to, I should have put that slide here, I did not. They set it up to be more balanced in gender and color and so on. But you can still get back to the old CEO by asking something kind of specific. If you ask for CEOs in northern Minnesota, it'll turn up like this again. Because again, it's just the white males just appear much more frequently on the internet. And so the way that they got it to be more balanced was by forcing the image to change. But they did that on top of the search, like they added it as kind of a guardrail. So we're going to change the results to make it more representational. So to wrap this up then, you can imagine you're hired by Google. You have this problem. All of a sudden, someone says, look, someone comes in, look, I have a daughter. I want my daughter, when she Google CEO, I want her to see that she could be a CEO. That's fair. And I'm knocking on the door of Google, and I say, what are you guys going to do about it? So that's a real question that you could face, and that Google did face just a few years ago, right? 2018, so it's only 6 years ago that they faced that. And then here I'm showing, this is just some data for you to see. Actually, as it turns out, the representation in internet searches of male and female, that's just a start. But at least in that one area, it turns out that it's, you can see it from the line, it's actually pretty close to how they actually men and women actually exist in the world. So when you have things like flight attendants, flight attendants are in fact overwhelmingly women. And what you find is that flight attendant, when you search, it normally is represented as a female, but there are many male flight attendants. And in fact, when you do the search, you do get a healthy number of males in there too. So someone who does the Google search for a flight attendant is going to get a picture which is more or less true. Now, you could say that representational fairness demands that when you Google flight attendant, you get 50% men and 50% women. You could say that. That's a fairness stand that can be supported just with the obvious argument that if you have a son and a daughter, you want them both to think equally that they could be flight attendants. So therefore, there should be an equal number of male and female flight attendants that come up on the search. Makes perfect sense. You could argue, by contrast, you want the search results to be true and also to at least represent the opportunity. And that's what happens with flight attendant. You get a little bit of both there. A true result also does, at least for male and female, produce some sense of opportunity for both genders. Okay. Take 5 minutes to answer the question on the previous slide. I think that the question I would like you to think about is this Google one. You know, imagine it's 2018. You work at Google. Someone comes in and they're outraged. They says, look, I have a daughter. I want her to think she can be a CEO. What do you do? What do you do? And why? Okay. Okay. And then this last point is just a couple of minutes, so we are wrapping up. The theoretical impossibility of fairness, always starting from unfairness, because always trying to compensate imbalance of first selection, first data, first application. Here's what I'm saying here. This goes back to the point I made at the start when I was arguing with my friend Vince Medai about, he was saying that we should not use the medical, skin cancer scanning AI until we're absolutely certain that it works for every race equally. And my response is, well, this opinion just doesn't make sense because all artificial intelligence is unfair right from the start because you always get one data point to begin. So the question I'm asking here is, well, everyone agrees that we should struggle to attain fairness, right? The real question is, how much are we willing to give up for it? Because we can never get true and perfect fairness. Right? Maybe if we could get true and perfect fairness, then in that case, maybe we could consider just giving up everything for fairness, but we can't. Fairness is always going to be imperfect. It was born imperfect. It was born that way, right? Because you got that first data point, which is whites and not blacks, or men and not women, or what have you. It doesn't matter. It's always unfair. It always starts that way. So if we're never going to have perfect fairness, then there is this question, and we've been asking it all the way through this entire session. The question is, what are we willing to give up for it? How much of our personal privacy are we willing to give up for fairness in order to know, say, that hiring algorithms are not arbitrarily eliminating older people? How much truth are we willing to give up in order to be certain that our daughters have the same feeling of access to the role of CEO as our sons? These are the real questions that surround fairness. Everyone wants fairness, but it is imperfect, and we're going to have to give up some things to get it. And that's what we have discussed mainly in this session on the most abstract level. More specifically, what we have said is we have defined fairness as equals treated equally and unequals treated unequally within the decision domain. That's the Aristotelian definition. We've seen how that works with the basketball example, and we have talked about how difficult it can be to apply that definition flawlessly in the world of artificial intelligence and the kinds of questions that tend to arise. And finally, to conclude, the kinds of questions that tend to arise when we talk about fairness is, what are the considerations that we should try to be fair about? Again, for basketball, if we're choosing basketball players, we should consider height. But if we are considering lawyers, we should not consider height. However, right, the blurry case I put in there, what about managers? So there are blurry cases in distributive fairness, and then the blurry cases we saw just now in representational fairness is, where maybe if we all agree that we should represent men and women equally, we should represent young and old, where does it stop? At some point, we can't represent absolutely everybody, right? There just is not enough space. So where does it stop and why? These are the kinds of questions that we struggle with in fairness. Okay, I think that's enough for today.